Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Jeffrey A. Singer, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute who works in the Department of Health Policy Studies. He's a president emeritus and founder of Valley Surgical Clinics, the largest and oldest group practice in Arizona. He's a steadfast advocate for clinically sound drug policy, particularly that of harm reduction. Along with Dr. Josh Bloom, he recently co-wrote an op-ed titled "For Measuring Opioid Strength the Wrong Way" in the New York Daily News, a highly recommended read for those interested in the harm reduction space. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Singer.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So today we're here to discuss how to think about the war on drugs and its latest manifestation, the opioid epidemic. So much of the war on drugs is a war on right thinking. And often when we discuss drug policy, particularly during the opioid epidemic, many disagreements arise from the way we think. Sometimes we think economically, sometimes medically, but meaningful solutions, I believe, come from combining these forms of thinking into a coherent policy. And Dr. Singer, that's really what we want to get from you today, just a sense of how to think about these issues at hand. And so I'd like to begin with the first question. When we discuss legislating drug access or drug use, we make conceptual leaps. We think medically, and then in terms of rights, and then in terms of protecting or restricting those rights. Can you talk through how you see this conceptual process taking place, particularly in your op-ed when you discuss the relationship between recommendations, gospels, and law? What do we get right and what do we get wrong about this?
Well, I come at it differently, actually. I come in the opposite direction. I start with rights. I don't start with medicine because I view every individual as sovereign with the inherent rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So when and of course the only legitimate function of the government is to secure those rights, and we have those rights to basically do anything to ourselves that we want to, providing we don't infringe on the rights, the same rights that others have. So I start from that premise, and when lawmakers suddenly create a list of unapproved substances to put into your body, I see that as an infringement of my rights. And it's also very arbitrary. Most of it's based upon personal biases. So for example, it's alcohol, which is an extremely dangerous drug. Of course, it's a psychoactive drug. But on top of that, it causes a lot of organ damage, whether we're talking about liver damage, pancreas damage, cancers, encephalopathy, you know, all that. And that's on the approved list. So we can take alcohol. But opioids, for example, which actually are a lot safer than alcohol. And by the way, you could overdose on alcohol as well. We all know that. And you can go into withdrawal if you're addicted to alcohol, and alcohol is very addictive. Well, opioids actually are probably less addictive than alcohol. They're certainly less likely to cause an overdose death. And they don't have any real end organ damage. They can cause constipation. There's evidence that prolonged use can perhaps affect your gonadal hormones, which might affect cause things like osteoporosis, which is treatable. But generally speaking, compared to alcohol, opioids are much safer. But for reasons that historically in this country also involve racism, it was put on the unapproved list. So the opioids were, of course, associated with Chinese immigrants coming to this country in the late 1800s, early 20th century. And it's interesting that they were made illegal first in states that had a high Chinese immigrant population, like California. They weren't illegal in Mississippi, where you didn't see a lot of Chinese immigrants. Cocaine, which is a legal drug, and it's on Schedule 2 of the, which means it has a medical use. Of course, we know we use this medically. That became illegal for personal use, non-medical use, because it was associated with quote-unquote drug-crazed Negroes who became impervious to bullets in the South. There were articles in New York Times talking, headlines in New York Times saying that. So there's an arbitrary list of approved and unapproved drugs. It's changed over history, what's approved and what isn't. And even if it isn't approved, the bottom line is, as an individual sovereign, I have the right to decide what I want to put into my body. Now, it becomes somebody else's problem if, for example, I get behind the wheel of a car and drive on public streets. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm perfectly fine with saying, if you're going to put something in your body that alters your consciousness, where you operate a vehicle and you could accidentally hurt someone else, then you can't do that. You can't operate a vehicle while you're under the influence. I'm fine with rules like that. But so I start from the premise that you're violating my rights when you're telling me that I'm not allowed to take a particular drug. That's where we begin. Then when we look at it from the medical standpoint, I think I just kind of talked about that. Most of the medical problems that arise from use of these disapproved drugs arise for the most part because they're prohibited. So, if people are forced to go to the black market to obtain these drugs because they're prohibited, then of course there's no quality control. There's no accountability. You think you're buying oxycodone because that you like the feeling you get from taking an oxycodone, but it turns out it was a counterfeit oxycodone pill made of fentanyl, and you just took a huge dose of an opioid that you were unaware of because you thought it was oxycodone and you'd overdose. So that's what happens when you go to the black market, or if you like particularly to inject an opioid or a cocaine or methamphetamine. Some people inject stimulants, of course. Well, you're going to have, since it's illegal, you have to get your needle and syringe, which is banned by paraphernalia laws, on the street, and you oftentimes share it with others or sell it to others so you can get some money to buy some more of the illicit drug. Well, of course, now you're spreading bloodborne infectious diseases like HIV, hepatitis. And also, since the needle's not clean, you're giving yourself a soft tissue infection. I'm a surgeon. I see people show up in the emergency room all the time with these terrible skin and soft tissue infections, abscesses from intravenous, from needle use. So most of these harmful effects are due to the fact that it's on a disapproved list. And so starting off, I'm saying you have no right to tell me what you approve. You could tell me what you approve of and don't approve of, but you don't have a right to enforce that on me. That's number one. Number two is most of the problems that you're creating. And then you point to, you say, see what these drugs do. You see, they cause overdoses. They cause the spread of HIV and hepatitis. They cause people to show up in emergency rooms with infections. Well, that's all because you won't let me have it legally, that you prohibit it. So you violate my rights, and then you create a whole bunch of problems by doing that. So that's the way I come at it. And then from the economic standpoint, any economist will tell you prohibition never works. Mm-hmm. I mean, we keep hearing people say, well, this fentanyl is coming across the border. We need to have tighter border security. Then how did he explain the fact that we can't keep it out of prisons? You can't get tighter security than that. The fact is, economists will tell you if there's a strong demand and there's a market for it, then somebody's going to meet that demand. And then, of course, they'll also point out to what's called the iron law of prohibition, mm-hmm. which the shorthand for that is the harder the enforcement, the harder the drug. So generally speaking, prohibition incentivizes the creation of more potent forms of whatever it is that you want to smuggle. Because if you're going to take the risk, you're going to take the risk for a bigger reward. It's also, if it's more concentrated and potent, usually you could smuggle it in smaller amounts. You could subdivide it into more products to sell. A perfect example, during alcohol prohibition, they weren't smuggling in beer and wine, they were smuggling in whiskey.
Yeah.
And even today, a live real world example is when people are tailgating at a football game, outside in the parking lot, they're drinking beer and wine, but you're not allowed to bring any alcohol into the stadium. So what do they usually put in the flask? They don't put beer and wine in the flask. They put whiskey or tequila or whatever, the hard stuff. It's the same thing. And so it's the iron law of prohibition that, for example, probably is why we have crack cocaine, because crack cocaine is just, you're able to smuggle it in smaller amounts and it's more potent. A lot of people, I think it's reasonable to speculate that we may never have had crack cocaine if you didn't have prohibition of cocaine. Fentanyl is making it into all of the opioids and also some of the stimulants, because some people like to mix the two. They usually like to mix heroin and cocaine or heroin and methamphetamine, but instead fentanyl is making its way into that. Probably this is illicit fentanyl, by the way, not the schedule two fentanyl that we prescribe.
Right.
This is made in labs, just like meth is made in labs and smuggled in. Well, it's because it makes enhances the potency of whatever it is that they're trying to smuggle. So you mix it in with heroin and you can smuggle in smaller amounts and smaller quantities and escape detection more easily. Also, during the, I think it's been magnified during the pandemic because supply chain problems affected everything. Yeah. So heroin has to be grown, it has to be processed, has to be smuggled. Fentanyl is much more easily made in a lab. So there's a lot of evidence that due to the pandemic, fentanyl substituted for heroin a lot by the cartels, by drug dealers and smugglers, because it was easier to substitute for the heroin, which the supply chain of heroin was disrupted. So that's probably contributed to the overdose death rate. So that's the way I look. The whole thing is basically irrational, and it's hurting people. And then the harm that it inflicts on people is pointed to as a reason to continue doing the same thing. Because rather than accept guilt for the harm that you've created on people, you blame it on the thing that you're prohibiting.
Certainly, you found quite a few interesting points to correlate together. And I think the most interesting of which is the tendency to put these broad economic metrics on something that's clearly an individual construct in terms of individual rights and personal medical decisions. Where do you think our fascination with the number of opioids prescribed, the supply came from? And why do we hold on to that when we know that's a poor proxy for overdoses or for the real effects of opioids?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the advocates of continuing drug prohibition are always looking for some scapegoat. If you look, you know, the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health author, the researchers there published a very interesting paper in September of 2018, where they were able, it was very difficult because of changes in terminology, but they were able to get CDC data going back to the late 1970s. And they showed that the overdose death rate has been growing exponentially since the 70s and predated the FDA's approval of OxyContin. And it's continuing now. And the only thing that's changed over the years is which particular drug seems to be more in vogue at any particular time. And then a year later, the Joint Economic Committee, of U.S. Congress, they published a report. And actually, they traced overdose death rate to starting its incline around 1959. Jeez. And that's available, you know, in the public domain, that report from the Joint Economic Committee in September 2019. So basically what I think happened is first you had this, myth that was created, not just about all of the prohibited drugs. You know, we were told that if you smoke marijuana, it can make you a crazed killer. Remember, there was that movie Reefer Madness that my fellow college students used to watch in the dorms, laughing while we were sharing, you know, joints, watching these people, you know, they take one puff and they go and they start attacking people. And so they started the propaganda back then. And opioids, I was in medical school when Richard Nixon was president. And towards the end, right before he left, and he started, you know, the new war on drugs, because it started actually in 1914 with the Harris Narcotics Act, but the latest war on drugs started in 1971 with Richard Nixon. And so we were being taught as medical students that opioids are dangerous, stay away from them, that highly deadly and highly addictive. And then and so was the general public. So I can remember in my early days in my surgical practice, I started my surgical practice in the 80s, I'd be making post-op rounds on my patients. And I'd see the, you know, major big abdominal incisions with, you know, big sutures, and patients obviously in pain, rapid pulse, sweaty, hyperventilating, grunting. And I say, did you let the nurse know? Because if you let the nurse know, they'll bring you morphine. I have morphine ordered for you. No, that's okay. It's okay. I don't want to get addicted. And I said, well, you're not going to get addicted if you take something. That's why it's there. That's what it's for. So it was on both sides of the bed, you know, the doctors and the patients were afraid. And then contrary to the narrative that's out there, which makes you think everything started with OxyContin in 1996,
yeah,
and their sales reps showing you this letter to the editor from the 1980s. Well, in the 70s and 80s already, many studies were coming out saying, you know, this is not as dangerous as the urban legend goes. And right. Actually, when used in a medical setting, it's very effective, and don't be afraid to use it. And we were getting encouragement throughout the 80s. And you could see there's data showing prescriptions of Dilaudid or hydromorphone and oxycodone started increasing throughout the 80s. By the late 80s, early 90s, we were getting encouraged by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, saying that there's this almost irrational fear associated with these drugs. Don't be afraid to use them. So we were getting encouraged, and eventually we started overcoming this opioid phobia, and so did the public. So by the, and if you look, I'm getting back to the University of Pittsburgh study, in the 70s, the popular drug for non-medical use was heroin and cocaine. Mm-hmm. And that continued into the early 90s. And then another popular drug in the 90s became Vicodin or hydrocodone. And then oxycodone, like Percocet or Percodan. And then after OxyContin came on the scene, and I'm not here to defend Purdue Pharma, and their sales reps may have been dishonest and overly, emphasizing the safety of the drug. I'm not here to defend them.
All things can be true.
Yeah, yeah. When OxyContin came out, OxyContin, as you know, is just concentrated oxycodone that's designed to be released more slowly. The thought was if it's released more slowly, it'll have more effective pain control. And there was no evidence for it, but they were saying that it make you less prone to getting addicted. And I want to talk about addiction in a little bit, but when oxycodone came out, by this time, the general public was comfortable with opioids, as were doctors. So already you had things like kids, high school kids or college kids a lot at parties. When you want to see where the drug use is rampant and drug selling is rampant, it's in college dorms. And so at parties, they would start using what we call diverted prescription pain pills. These are either stolen from medicine cabinets or stolen from trucks that were delivering them or from pharmacies, and they get their way into the black market. And so, recreational drug users say, hey, try this oxycodone. You love the feel. And if you crush it and snort it, it takes effect more quickly. You'll love the feeling. So people were already using that. When OxyContin came out, that was even better because you get a much greater dose. So that became popular. And so from about the late 90s to the early 00s, the most popular drug for non-medical users had become the prescription pain pills. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, that was a rational decision. I said this recently. I think I was interviewed on another podcast. And I said, if a person came to me and said, oh, when I was on the Cato Institute, I had an online event the other day mm-hmm. about this. That's where I said it. And if a patient came to me and said, doc, I'm going to recreationally use a drug tonight. You can't talk me out of it. I have in my hand this bottle of oxycodone that I stole from my grandmother's medicine cabinet. I have in this hand a bag of something a guy sold me on the street. He told me it's heroin. I'm going to use one or the other. Which, if you were me, which would you use?
Yeah, certainly.
I would I would definitely use the thing from the medicine cabinet because I know exactly what that is. And whatever dose it is, we know what it is. So if there's any problem, we know just what to do. And you know just how much to take. Right. That other thing, I'm not sure it's even what you were told it is or what's in it. Could it be fentanyl? So that's what I would do. So that was actually a rational choice. Well, what was happening is if you see that this was a steady increase and the population was growing, so greater numbers of people, mm-hmm. Like 1% of 300,000 is a larger number than 1% of 30,000. So larger numbers of people were using drugs non-medically. And in the early part of the war on drugs in the 70s and 80s, most people associated, non-medical drug use with marginalized groups, people living in a city, minorities. which, by the way, had a lot to do with getting those drugs made illegal, because the average American was saying, well, that doesn't involve me anyway. So sure, make it illegal. And if you're telling me that it makes those people more of a threat to me because they could become drug crazed, make it illegal. Yeah. Well, all of a sudden, you know, America's white middle class kids were starting to use these drugs. And now all of a sudden it's a problem. Now all of a sudden people are taking note. So since doctors were, first of all, since doctors were prescribing opioids more liberally, and for the most case, they were rightly doing it. And since people had overcome their fear of prescription opioids and actually were choosing them for non-medical use over other drugs that were offered to them by dealers on the street, it stood to reason that you're going to see more overdoses related to that drug. And that's what caught the nation's attention. So, rather than think maybe prohibition is driving the overdose rate, because as you know, something like 90%+ of the overdoses associated with diverted prescription pain pills were poly drug. They involved other drugs like heroin, alcohol, benzodiazepines. These were people who were not patients. These were people who were using recreationally. Well, rather than blame prohibition, they wanted to blame, of course, the opioid, the pill, and doctors prescribing it. So it was basically they're evading the truth. And now, to be fair, there were doctors who were misbehaving. Okay, I'm putting that mildly. There were doctors who were bad. They were using their MD degree as a cover for doing drug dealing. So you had reports, there was a doctor arrested in Orange County, California, for selling prescriptions at $600 a pop at a Starbucks every day. You knew where to find them. There was doctors operating pill mills, as they call them, which were basically, you know, we learned about the Oxy Express, they called it, in Florida, where drug dealers would fly people down from New York and you know, pay their way and give them perks and tell them, go to this clinic and ask this doctor and say these things to him. He'll give you a prescription for 500 OxyContin. Then go to this particular pharmacy. Make sure you speak to this particular pharmacist. He'll fill it and then bring it to me and I'll give you X amount of money. So now those were bad actors. Yeah. But again, I wouldn't blame the pain pills. I wouldn't blame the treatment of pain. What I would blame for that is prohibition, because it's prohibition that made it appealing to a doctor. If it wasn't for prohibition, the doctor wouldn't be able to get $600 for selling a prescription.
Yeah, exactly.
And the operators of these pain pill mills wouldn't have been making all this money if it wasn't for the fact that they had found a way to get a product that's prohibited to the market.
Yeah.
And so again, you blame drug. You know, prohibition corrupts the corruptible. It doesn't just corrupt doctors and pharmacists; it corrupts police. I mean, you know, everybody knows stories about police who are a part of the on the take, prosecutors, politicians. That's another unintended consequence of prohibition is it actually undermines the morals and it undermines the rule of law, because when something, and that's what happened during alcohol prohibition as well, of course, when something is going to be done, even though it's illegal, and it becomes attractive to do it because it's illegal, then it makes the entire criminal justice system corrupt. And it makes the average person wonder, why should they obey any law? I mean, nobody's obeying this one. And a lot of people are making money over enforcing it. So so now, of course, they've cracked that. They decided that it's the doctors prescribing opioids. That was an easy answer to them. So where are we now? So since about 2012 is the peak year of prescription opioid prescribing, according to data from the CDC. It's gone down as a percentage every year since. So prescriptions, prescriptions of opioids per 100 population is down about 60% since 2012. Overdose deaths are soaring. They're up about 50% since 2012. And if you look at the percentage of them that involves prescription opioids, that dropped dramatically as the prescription opioids became less available for diversion. So now it's only about maybe between 10 and 13%. It's and it's not the cause, it's involved, it's found in people. And 83% of opioid-related overdose deaths now involve illicit fentanyl. And if you look at the data, you can see as soon as it became difficult for people to obtain diverted prescription pain pills, they just moved over to the next available thing, which first was heroin and then heroin laced with fentanyl. I'm told by researchers that fentanyl is actually not the drug of choice for most recreational opioid users. Really? They view it as, I mean, some enjoy the feeling, but Dr. Dan Ciccarone, who's at UCSF Medical School, he's doing a heroin in transition study for the NIH. And he's been on the street interviewing IV drug users, almost like an anthropologic study. And they tell him that it's a totally different feeling that you get from fentanyl than you get from heroin. And most people don't like the feeling they get. They prefer the heroin feeling. And they view fentanyl as a contaminant. And it's valuable to them to know if there's fentanyl in it, because they're going to adjust their dose accordingly. So, but anyway, that's where we are now. And then I published in the Journal of Pain Research, along with Michael Shatman and Jacob Sullum, back in 2019. We looked at the numbers, and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is part of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, they, since 2002, every year they conduct what's called the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. It's sort of like a census thing. And if you look at their numbers from 2002 on, past months, past months, non-medical use of prescription pain relievers in persons age 12 and up is basically a flat line since they started taking the survey. And past year diagnosed with prescription pain reliever use disorder, persons age 12 and up. Again, basically, you know, there's little bumps, but it's basically a straight line since they started taking the survey. Meanwhile, during that period, from 2002 to 2012, prescription opioids per 100 population doubled, and then it's come down 60%. So there's no correlation between the number of prescriptions we write and people who are the percentage of people who are non-medical users or who develop opioid use disorder. So this just reinforces, well, first of all, this goes against the notion that the drug prohibitionists would like to promulgate, which is that all these people we're hearing about dying on the street from heroin overdoses or fentanyl overdoses, these were created by us doctors. Created a do people still believe that, you know, 10 years after we cut people off from opioids, we still got this population of people walking around with, you know, that's number one. Number two, it should be obvious that as prescription volume per 100 population increased, there was more available for diversion to the black market for people who wanted a recreational use. And then when that source dried up, the recreational users just moved on to the next source. It's obvious. And, you know, the same thing happened with meth, by the way. In 2005, Congress solved the meth crisis. We had a meth crisis, you may remember. And they passed a law that made Sudafed, which was being used in local meth labs to make meth, they made Sudafed behind the counter, and they limited how much you could have, which is really unfortunate because it's a really good decongestant. And so now you got to give your driver's license. So, and then, of course, SWAT teams started raiding all these local meth labs. And meth was about the only thing the drug cartels weren't involved in because there was no market for them because there were so many local meth labs. But once those labs disappeared, now the market opened up for the drug cartels in Mexico. And if anybody has not seen Breaking Bad, they should. But they should, if they did, they'll know that there are much more efficient ways to make meth than with Sudafed, including P2P or phenyl-2-propanone. And you can make a higher quality, higher concentration meth. So that's what they've been doing. And now meth, if you look at the latest numbers from the CDC, meth-related deaths are at a record high, 22,000 out of the 100,000 overdose deaths for the year ending April 2021, 22,000 involved meth and 23,000 involved cocaine. So it was like, I think it was like 4,000 in 2005, something like that. So how's that working out? Meanwhile, nothing... They never undo what they did. So I still have to just like I still have, we still have to take our shoes off at the airport for TSA. I still have to give my driver's license to get Sudafed when I'm, I got a really stuffed up nose. That's never going to go. That's never going to go away. Doesn't matter. Yeah. So anyway, and then I wanted to mention about addiction. I think a big part of this problem is many people, including a lot of us doctors, we're guilty of this too. We conflate the terms addiction and dependency, and they're two completely different things. So as you know, dependency is when you're the simplistic way is you physiologically adapt to the presence of the drug. That tolerance is a part of that process as well. And then if you abruptly withdraw the drug, you could get a withdrawal reaction. In some cases, depending on the drug, could be fatal. So for example, you see this with anti-epileptics. And if you abruptly withdraw the anti-epilepsy drug, people could have terrible, they can go into status epilepticus seizures. Beta blockers, which are very commonly used for high blood pressure. When you're on them for a long portion of time, you can't abruptly withdraw them, or you could, you could actually have a stroke or a heart attack and die. Opioids are drugs like that too, where you develop this dependence. That's not being addicted. Nobody would say you're addicted to an anti-epileptic drug, or you're addicted to a beta blocker. It was the same with opioids. Now, addiction is defined as compulsive use despite negative consequences. Okay. And it doesn't just have to be to a substance. It could be to a behavior. It's a compulsive behavioral disorder. So gambling addiction, okay, that's an addiction. And it, despite negative consequences, you know, gambling addiction, you can go into all sorts of debt, get into trouble with loan sharks, and you can't stop gambling. Shopping addiction, sex addiction. But then when it comes to certain drugs, you have the same thing. So alcohol is a very common example. You know, your marriage broke up, you lost your job, you're living in a flop house, you're working as a, you know, a dishwasher to just pay for the flop house you're living in, and you know it's because of the alcohol, and you swear to yourself, tomorrow I'm going to go get help, and then you can't because it's calling to you, because this either activity or substance, it's become automatized as filling some sort of need that that you're triggered to want. Well, that's addiction, and addiction, study after study has shown that, including Dr. Nora Valco of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, publishing in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2016, said that addiction in people on long-term opioids, even in those with pre-existing vulnerabilities, is very rare. And depending on which study you read, it's anywhere from 1% to 5%. Yet at the hospital that I work at, when I prescribe an opioid for my patient for post-op pain, they're supposed to sign a consent form. They don't have to sign a consent form for the antibiotic or for the, you know, whatever else I prescribe for them, but for the opioid, I have to, and it says on a consent form, I understand that I have a 10% chance of addiction, which is a lie. It's not true. And the other thing is, I've heard a lot of addiction specialists say this, and to me, this is the best way to understand it. The drug is not addictive. You become addicted to the drug or the activity. Gambling's not addictive. I gambled when I go to Las Vegas. It doesn't addict me. It's not that addicts me. I have some internal things going on that make me become addicted to that particular substance or activity. And people don't understand that. So we're thinking that, you know, these doctors created addicts. No, they didn't create. In fact, Dr. Stanton Peel spoke at the Cato Institute in December 2019, and he turned to the audience. It was in the auditorium at Cato. And he said, how many people here have ever been given an opioid after a procedure of some sort? And huge number of people raised their hand. Say, okay, how many people here got addicted after that? And all the hands stayed down. Really? None of you became addicted? How many people had leftover pills after, you know, you took it, but you had leftover? And most of the hands, or a lot of the hands, went up. And he said, so what'd you do with them? They just, you know, said, well, I kept them in case I need them down the road or whatever. Oh, because if you were addicted, you would have kept using them and asked for more, right? Or if you were a dealer, you would have sold them. So anyway, these are all the prohibitionists have created a myth. So soon, in fact, they're already moving away. I think everybody recognizes now that the overdoses are not due to prescription pain pills anymore. They're due to fentanyl. So now they're blaming it on illegal immigration, right? That's the new thing. This is all due to illegal immigration. They're coming across their border with the fentanyl.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. First of all, it's not the people coming across the Rio Grande River with the fentanyl. The people coming in with the fentanyl are coming in through the checkpoints. Yeah. And the fentanyl is usually either in body cavities or hidden under car seats or, you know, hidden very nicely because it comes into prisons. So if you can get it into a prison, you can get across the regular checkpoint. You're not going to go to the bother of swimming across the Rio Grande River to do it.
Exactly.
So, but and then when that doesn't work, they'll come up with another excuse.
So inherent in what you had mentioned is a complex mix of cause and effect that may not really be cause and effect, and our inability to just understand substitution patterns of behavior. You talked about that with gambling. You talked about with alcohol. Is it that we just choose not to look at the drug issues in this country the right way, that we're just looking for scapegoats because people have the wrong incentives, or we're just in some way stuck to these antiquated narratives, or possibly both?
I think it's both. I think, you know, the other day in our conference on this, Dr. Carl Hart said, you know, he corrected me. I said the drug war has been an abject failure. And he said, I take issue with that because it's been a big success for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's a success for prosecutors, for police, for the prison industry. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot of it from the rehab centers that people get forced to go to through drug courts. So it's been, if it was a failure, it would have stopped.
Right.
So for the people, there are a lot of people benefiting from it. It's a failure in terms of its goal of stopping drug use. So there's that. And like I said, a lot. So you got these incentives of some people, they're invested in this. So they're not going to want to change it. Then you got people who are just, you know, we've all been taught things since we were kids. We taught about the evils of these drugs, the dangers of these drugs. And then I don't really think a lot of the drug prohibition is racially motivated. I think a lot of the early drugs that were prohibited, we used racism and bigotry to get the prohibitions enacted. But, you know, we're 100 years later now, and most of the people probably aren't aware of how it all started. So that's the problem we're up against. And then, of course, you have policymakers and lawmakers who don't have an understanding, and even a lot of doctors who don't have a clear understanding of what substance use disorder is, like we just talked about. I think if we cornered the average doctor that we work with who doesn't deal with these issues, they probably would not be able to tell us the difference between the addiction and dependence.
Yeah.
And they probably wouldn't be able to talk about how you get addicted to the drug doesn't addict you, because they haven't studied it.
It's interesting how in the face of a powerful narrative, facts go out the window, no matter how intelligent or how learned you are. Now, you had mentioned about some positive changes. You mentioned that even the prohibitionists are starting to recognize that what they were alluding to with the prescription opioids and the overdoses was a false equivalency at best, giving them the benefit of the doubt. The CDC recently came out with guidelines that you have spoken about widely that have some positive effect in terms of acknowledging past mistakes, but the general perception of opioids remains the same.
Right.
We have prominent legal case coming forward that you and I have discussed, Ruan v. USA, in which the Supreme Court will determine the definition of good faith as it pertains to physician prescribing practices. So there is a certain wind that's moving in a different direction. Where do you see the inflection point of change coming into the minds of the public? Is it from the court rulings? Is it from the federal policies, or is some sort of kind of balance of both?
Well, I think there's a lot of things happening at the same time. First, let me speak to the CDC guidelines. They realized that they created a monster because they said in 2016, none of this is meant to be taken as the gospel. A lot of this is based on what they call type 4 information, which is the weakest data and information and subject to change. And then a whole lot of politicians said when they saw them say, but generally speaking, we recommend not exceeding this and this dose. The politicians with their simplistic thinking and the media as well say, oh, CDC says don't take more than this dose. And we're seeing this now with COVID, right? So whatever the CDC says, that's what we do. Okay. And even though they didn't read the fine print, we said, we say we think, but we're not sure. That doesn't matter. So the CDC in 2019, it was already too late because by that time, 36 states enacted their guidelines into law. The CDC said, no, we never meant that. We meant that just use it as a loop. You never did what we wanted to do. And the AMA started chiming in and complaining and all that, American Medical Association. Anyway, so now they're coming out with new guidelines. And now they take pains to stress over and over again, please do not enact this. Do not put this into, this is still based on, you know, every patient's different and every doctor knows their patient. And they do all those kind of disclaimers, but they still basically say, we recommend this amount. And in both the 2016 guidelines and these guidelines, the new guidelines that'll be coming out later this year, it seems that they stick to this morphine milligram equivalent conversion table. And this isn't, I had an op-ed in yesterday's New York Daily News with Josh Bloom, who's the director of pharmaceutical and chemical science at American Council on Science and Health. We co-authored it, but we're not the first ones to discover it. Actually, it was brought to our attention by Nabarin Dasgupta. And he directed us to papers that were done by people like Jeffrey Fuden, an academic pharmacologist, and Michael Shatman, a pain and specialist psychologist at Tufts University, and others. Many articles, but they seem to be kind of just shouting in the wind, showing that these morphine milligram equivalent conversion tables are, number one, unscientific, and number two, pharmacologically impossible. So, for example, it says 1 milligram of morphine equals, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's 1.5 milligrams of oxycodone. Okay. But morphine is usually given intravenously. It doesn't have to be, but that's what we usually give it. And oxycodone is usually given orally. So you're telling me that oral, which gets absorbed at a much different rate, is the same as IV morphine? So allowances for means of administration, bioavailability, different drugs get absorbed and taken up and metabolized at different rates. Individuals vary genetically on the enzymes, the way their enzymes work to metabolize the different opioids. So two different people, just like with alcohol, you know, one person could have one glass of wine and be tipsy. Another person could have one glass of wine. It didn't touch them. Same thing. And then not only that, but it's dependent on what other drugs are in their system, because a lot of the drugs could affect the enzymes that metabolize the opioid. It depends on their kidney function, depends on their blood volume, it depends on their BMI. So pharmacologists and biochemists will tell you, you can't make an equivalent. You can't say, you know, X amount of oxycodone or X amount of hydrocodone equals this amount of morphine. So just on a scientific level, they've been saying that for a long time. But aside from that, was to me was the big discovery. I'm embarrassed because people I know have been saying this for a number of years. I was late to the game. But the big discovery is that these conversion tables that were put into the 2016 CDC guidelines were based on a paper from 2008. And that paper cited a 2005 study, which basically synthesized several 40 and 50 year old and 60-year-old single-dose clinical trials based on things like pain scores. It's totally subjective. None of the studies were based on any toxicological evaluations like respiratory depression rates or anything like that. This is not an exaggeration. Okay. Things like one person would be given opioid A, another one would be given opioid B. They'd be asked on a score of 1 to 10, how's your pain now? And if they both said 5, then they're equivalent. Those kind of studies, believe it or not, or how long did it take for the opioid to wear off? And there were not even in these studies, because Dr. Dasgupta helped us find some of these. We dug into them in the past. Some of them didn't even adjust for rate of means of administration. So you're comparing intravenous to oral, apples and oranges. Well, those got synthesized together. There were so many of these tables going around that different researchers were just kind of using to help do research. And so we decided to use this in this table adopted from researcher X in 1985. And eventually this researcher in 2005 kind of took them all and came up with his own table based upon them. And then that was used by the 2008 paper. And the 2008 paper was cited by the CDC. It's sort of like the CDC citing studies showing that, you know, masks work in schools,
yeah,
because by showing, well, this school district had a lower incidence of COVID and they had mask mandate, and the other school district didn't have a mask mandate and their incidence of COVID was higher, without looking into any other variables, including, well, how many kids were there wasn't a mask mandate, were still wearing masks, and also, yeah, you know, same kind of, that kind of crap. That's crap. Okay. It so is. The CDC is still sticking with that. In the new guidelines, they're still saying, of be careful once you exceed 50 morphine milligram equivalents of an opioid. And I'm looking at this and saying, number one, scientifically makes sense. Number two, that's a BS morphine equivalent table, and it's still in there. So the problem I have with it is they haven't really changed what they're doing. No. They just basically emphasized that they don't want people to take this as the gospel and to cast it in stone. But then you got to be a realist, okay? So in the real world, when the CDC says something, no matter how much they have disclaimers, the press and the politicians are going to respond by saying, this is what the CDC recommends. We're going to put it into law.
Yeah.
And I've argued, when these states that have put this into law, if there's anything we should have learned from these last 2 years of the COVID pandemic, everybody should have come away with the understanding that science is a process. Yeah. And that our knowledge is changing almost on a daily basis, and different really smart people could disagree on how to interpret the data, and individuals respond differently to the interventions that are made based upon these data. And so if you put today's CDC opinion into law, you have now taken a snapshot in time and made it into concrete, so that if tomorrow they change their opinion and it was all wrong and they do a 180, you're stuck with that other opinion in law until you have another session of the legislature to repeat that. That's no way to do. You don't do science that way. You have the lawmakers stay out of it. Now, I'm happy to say in my state, I've been saying this, and they're making some changes. The Senate Majority Leader, I'm sorry, not the Senate Chair of the House, the Chair of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee in Arizona,
has
heard from a lot of pain patients. And this is another thing why I think things are going to change. And she contacted me and said, what can we do? We've created a problem here where we have patients are miserable. They're suffering. They're turning to the black market for relief, or they're committing suicide. And I said, well, number one, you got to undo the concretization of the 2016 CDC guidelines that you put into law. Number two, another thing that's terrorizing doctors into underprescribing is, you all they have to do is turn on the news one night and see a news report of a SWAT team raiding a doctor's office with a waiting room full of patients, and then him being walked out of the office in handcuffs. And every doctor looks at that and says, well, that's it. I'm not prescribing any more pain medicine. I'm just going to refer him to a pain specialist. I can't take that risk. And the pain specialist, they're getting swamped with people who they really don't need to see. So you can't see the pain specialist for 3 months. And the patient is being told, I can't see you for 3 months. Why don't you go see an addiction specialist? And the patient, well, I'm not addicted. I don't need an addiction specialist. I need pain medicine. I'm in pain. So that's what's going on right now. Yeah. So I testified on this yesterday, and it passed unanimously out of the committee.
Oh, congratulations.
The first bill passed the Senate, which, for all intents and purposes, undoes all of the restrictions that were placed on prescribing. Mm-hmm. The way she did it was more, she's the politician, I'm not. So she kept some of the original restrictive language in place because you got people who are invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then added, except under this circumstance and this circumstance and this circumstance. And by the time you're done, it's basically, these are the restrictions, except the doctor doesn't think they're necessary.
Yeah.
So that's basically it. So that passed the Senate and it's going to the House. And the other bill is, it says that if law enforcement wants to look at the PDMP, which is the prescription drug database, they need to get a warrant signed by a judge saying there's probable cause of crimes being committed. And then if they get that warrant and they don't find a statutory evidence of a statutory crime, but they think a prescriber is prescribing outside of the norm, then they may report that to the relevant licensing board as a possible deviation from the standard of care for that licensing board to look into, but they may not take any criminal proceedings against the prescriber. And that just passed through committee unanimously. And I think that what all state legislators need to do is 18 states already require a search warrant. Hopefully Arizona will become the 19th. But what legislators need to do is avoid legislating science. Science is not a law. Science is a process, of discovery. You can't put today's discovery into law or today's understanding of a discovery into law. So get rid of that, and also make it so that law enforcement is not practicing medicine. If law enforcement thinks that a doctor is perhaps doing something that's looks a little suspicious, that's what licensing boards are supposedly for, right? They're supposed to be policing the people they license. And at least that way the doctor has due process in front of peers, where the doctor can explain to peers who deal with this why the prescribing patterns may look a little unusual because of their particular patient base. And their peers will either say, okay, I can see that, that was reasonable, or maybe they won't see it. And they'll take whatever action is appropriate, including it can go as far as, you know, losing your license, or it could be just educational or whatever, but that's the way it should be done. And I think if that were to happen, eventually, it's not going to happen overnight, but eventually doctors will start to overcome their fear of prescribing again, because they know they'll be treated fairly.
No, I certainly hope that happens sooner than later. And the other thing that's happening sooner than later is a Supreme Court case determining the matters of good faith. What are your thoughts on that case, Roe v. United States, and will that have as much of an impact, you could say, as the CDC guidelines, or is that too narrow of a scope to have much of an impact?
You know, I'm not a legal expert, so I can't really tell you about its impact, but I can tell you that it relates to what I was just saying, because it's basically in that case, Ruan v. USA, for those who don't know about it, it's a doctor was charged with basically drug dealing for all intents and purposes, because the doctor, Ruan, was prescribing beyond the limits suggested by the CDC, basically, that were put into statute in that state of Alabama. So the doctor wanted the opportunity to explain that, actually, I got a rationale for this. I wasn't drug dealing. Based upon my patient's situation, there was a good reason for me to be doing this. And if anybody's doctor's gone to a medical meeting, or any person's had a chance to see one, sometimes there are clinical situations where you could have a panel of specialists, all really good specialists, who could have a disagreement over what's the best way to treat that. That's, you know, it's not a settled science. But if the doctor can prove that I was acting in good faith, you may disagree with my clinical approach, and in hindsight, maybe it was the wrong clinical approach, but I wasn't drug dealing. I was trying to help my patient based upon what I know. And he wanted to offer that defense. They didn't give him a chance to offer that defense. And so it's the same, it's kind of, when you think about it, it's the same thing, right? It's cops practicing medicine.
Yeah.
So that's why I think another remedy is to say that law enforcement, if they think you're prescribing, unless they could show like you're selling drugs, you know, on the street, or, you know, you're involved in some sort of racket, like some of these pill mill operators were. We have a deal with a drug dealer, and you know, talk to this guy. Well, if you could prove that kind of stuff, that's one thing. But if you just think a doctor is prescribing outside of the standard of care, well, that's a standard of care issue. That's not a crime issue. And law enforcement, you don't need people with guns to even be involved in it. And cops and judges really don't know anything special about how to treat pain.
No, they don't.
So they got no business deciding it. It should be decided by the licensing board that deals with people who do that.
Well said. And Dr. Singer, I want to be respectful of your time. So I want to leave you with one question that I think the listening audience would really gravitate towards. And that is, how can each individual who's been affected, either directly or indirectly, have their voice be heard? You talked about your efforts in Arizona and successfully having the voices of pain patients being heard. But for the patient in Alaska or the physician in Florida? What are the means by which they can work with their local legislators, work with their local policymakers to really have their voices heard? What advice would you give to them?
Well, I think actually the people that politicians listen to most are the patients, not the professionals.
Yeah.
They're larger in number, and they also have very, very, you know, heart-rending stories. So what we're seeing is patient advocacy groups developing across the nation and networking. And so get involved with them, because they usually are state chapters of these national groups, because that's, for example, what drove the legislator here in Arizona.
Yeah.
That's what caught her attention. These are personal stories. And now many people have either experienced or know somebody who's experienced being undertreated for pain, or being literally cut off from pain medicine and becoming disabled again. So they're the most, I think, effective. So they need to get vocal, they need to organize, they need to talk to their legislators and other representatives. When it comes to the prescribers, the health, whether you're a physician or a nurse practitioner, whatever healthcare profession you're in, your professional organizations need to step up. A lot of them, to be honest with you, you know, they're kind of co-opted. A lot of them are compromised because a lot of them depend on certain privileges that they've been able to extract from the political class, and they don't want to rock the boat. So that's been a problem. So, for example, the American Medical Association, finally, they've stepped up and gotten very vocal about this in the last couple of years, but they were very silent in the beginning. And, you know, they depend on, for example, Congress granted them a monopoly on the coding that's used for billing back in the 80s. That's a big moneymaker for them. They don't want to anger them, things like that. So, and they're also busy negotiating, you know, regarding Medicare payment schedules and things like that. So they're less reliable, in my opinion, but they need to step up. Also a lot of academics. There are some courageous academics out there who are speaking out, but they're also under pressure. We see this, we saw this with COVID. We see this with a lot of the sciences, because he who pays the piper calls the tune. And a lot of research grants are dependent upon not bucking the narrative that the person who gives out the grant money subscribes to.
Yep.
So that makes it tough too, because a lot of the very highly respected people who may privately agree with us are afraid to speak out because they don't want to jeopardize their grant proposal. Yeah. So, but I think out of all, the most effective are the patients. Those are the ones that people listen to. And those stories are heartbreaking.
Yeah, certainly. Many stories and now totaling in the millions of patients across this country. And I think that it's high time something gets done. And so with that, Dr. Singer, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate your insight and look forward to continuing the discussion.
Thank you for having me here. It was a pleasure.